Hey everyone, and welcome to the Fideus Club. This is episode 84. We're in March 2017, and in this special, we're going to be talking about Zimbabwe. Hello everyone, and welcome to the Fideus Club. My name is Patrick Beja, and this is a special episode. Usually what we do is that we get different people from different countries to talk about the world events, but in special episodes, we get one or two people from one specific area of interest or country, and we talk about that country specifically. And today we're going to do that about Zimbabwe. And before we launch into the conversation itself, I just want to mention that we're going to be focusing on the daily life in Zimbabwe and going to not talk about all of the political aspects of it, which are very peculiar, but we're really going to talk about how life is in Zimbabwe and try to get you an idea of what happens, to how people go about their business on a daily basis. And hopefully you haven't heard about this a lot, so it will bring you a little bit of awareness. I know that certainly for me that's the case. So let me welcome to the show first, Bongai. As I always say, I hope I'm not mispronouncing your name, but welcome to the show, Bongai.
Thank you, Patrick.
So you are native of Zimbabwe. You've been living there for a long time, and you're a, as you described it, a businessman.
Yeah, wasn't born in Zimbabwe. My parents lived in Zambia at the time. My father was declared persona non grata, so right. Moved back when I was one, but I've been here pretty much my whole life.
Okay, and so you're a businessman. You used to do a little bit of radio as well. And
Well, radio, I used to host a radio show on Star FM, which is Zimbabwe's biggest urban radio station. And I also used to host a show called The Bottom Line, which is a business radio show with different guests coming on representing different sectors of the economy, occasionally getting representatives from government as well, just giving insight on things that are going on in and around the country. And my business is mainly in hospitality, casual dining, and bars.
All right, cool. Thank you very much. And we also have Bruce, you were born in Zimbabwe, actually, but you're originally European, and now you're back in Ireland, right?
Scotland at the moment. So
same thing. It's like gone. The countries around, in the UK, it's fine.
Like you're from Spain, Patrick.
Yeah, basically.
I was born in Zimbabwe to parents who were from Europe. Mother was Italian and dad was English, but they were more Zimbabwean than I was because they lived there for longer than I did. But currently live in Scotland with wife and kids, working for a very exciting job in the council, which we won't go into details.
It sounds fascinating. But all right, so you did live for a couple of decades in Zimbabwe, and I think you tried to go back, but you couldn't find work, so is my understanding. So you have a deep-seated love for the country. Is my understanding. And
yeah, sorry, Patrick. Yeah, Zimbabwe will always be my spiritual home. I was born there. I left when I was 23, and then went back for a couple of years, a few years ago, and just couldn't find the work. And
With a family, I'm sure it must be a little bit difficult.
I do go back every couple of years on holiday to see my family. So, right. I love the country and I love the people.
And so actually, Bongai and Bruce, you've known each other forever. You're friends and you've known each other since your childhood.
It's probably going on, 34 years now, Bruce?
I would say that. We met in, I think it was the first day in junior school. We went to the same junior school together. My mum always loved the story that on the first day I tripped over something and Bongai was the only guy to come over and offer to pick me up or help me up. So she was, and that was our first.
I think it was a case of us fat kids having to hang out together, mate.
Yes, yeah, we're both substantial people. Bongai's taken advantage of it recently. He started the gym, but I've kind of let myself go.
All right, well, so let's first of all, I know, as I joked about when we before we started recording, I know nothing about Zimbabwe. I'm basically the biggest Zimbabwe noob that you'll ever find. I hope I don't make too much of a fool of myself. I already started, you know, by equating Scotland with Ireland, but I'm going to try and not to do that too much in the next few couple of minutes. But for me, Zimbabwe is basically, yeah, it's that country. It's a country in Africa, right? The big, like, Africa is one thing and Zimbabwe is a part of it. And that's my extent, the extent of my knowledge of Zimbabwe. So I apologize to basically everyone in the world for being an idiot. But let's start with that. I'm actually intrigued by your first days of school. How does that go in Zimbabwe? Maybe Bonga, you know, if you ask me, I have a very caricatural image of Zimbabwe. I'm not even sure, you know, if we go to the extreme, I'm like, oh, so it's like you have to walk 20 miles to go to the school in like a village where that doesn't have electricity or water. Like, obviously, you know, I don't know where you were, but I'm guessing that's not the case. But how does that go? You go to school. What do? You wake up, you take a bus, you go there, you have 8 hours of school. How does it go the first few hours of the day in the school?
I think what you got to understand is Zimbabwe is a bit of a dichotomy between the rural and urban, and the majority of Zimbabwean population is very rural. So the rural lifestyle that they're exposed to is very different from one that we grew up with. And rural lifestyle is probably the caricature that most people would have an understanding of, you know, people waking up early in the morning, having to do chores before they get to school. Young girls might be the ones responsible for sorting out water, etc., and helping their mothers cook. And yes, in the rural areas, people tend to walk to school. Some do walk long distances going to school. When you contrast that with the urban life, there's also a dichotomy in urban life. And what we have, the low density suburbs, as we call it, and what we have, high density suburbs. So your low density suburbs tend to be your more affluent suburbs. So those middle class to upper class, high end houses, and your high density tend to be your blue collar working life. People in the high density suburbs, as we call them, blue collar workers, the kids who go to school will definitely be catching public transport to get to school. A lot of the schools will be in those areas as well, but some people will cross town and go to different schools. And then the more affluent suburbs, your low density suburbs, people will definitely be going to school by car. I mean, when we grew up, we used to ride to school. Some guys used to walk to school if they live pretty close by. And the curriculum is pretty much the same across the board. We have a number of different examination boards that people will be able to subscribe to, and a lot of them are international. Predominantly used to be very British in the system with the Cambridge Examination Board, but now people even do the IB, International Baccalaureate. You have a number of international schools. My kids go to the French school, so that's
a
French.
Excellent. I approve of
that. Very good. So that's a French school. So they learn in multiple languages, and that follows, you know, the French system. So my son went in, and he was in très petit section, and you know, my daughter's in moyen section, and so that you have those schools, you have the international schools as well, but the majority of Zimbabweans will go to a Zimbabwean school. So the school that Bruce and I went to, St. John's, was a school in an affluent suburb. And, you know, we grew up in a very, very good environment, you know, where we had fantastic teachers, great environment. We had milk at break time, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning, you went out and ran around and played in the fields. Very big on sport. Zimbabwe is a very sporty country, so there's lots of organized sport. And as kids, we played a number of different sports. We had clubs as well. I think Bruce and I probably both played chess. There's choirs, there's drama, there's a whole lot of activities at junior school level. And as you progress and go through senior school, those are added on as well. Bruce and I went to separate senior schools, but at my senior school, you had a range of different activities and sports. I mean, we had shooting. Guys were members of the shooting club. You could be in the choir. You could be playing instruments, a cappella, or playing first team rugby. So there was a lot of progression as we grew older. Schools tended to be really focused on academics and sport, but a big cultural wave came through in Zimbabwe in the mid-90s, and there are a lot more activities going on in different schools. Not to say that didn't exist before, but they're now put on par. There was a time when if you didn't play first-team rugby, you weren't recognized for your skills and talents, but people had the opportunity to express themselves in different ways, and I think it was a very good thing.
When you say if you didn't play rugby, you weren't recognized for your talents in rugby, or like
no, rugby was the epitome traditionally. So if you look at most schools, and still is to a large extent, the probably one of the most important schools, important sports in private schools, and to in some of your top government schools. What I'm saying is that then there was that progression that recognized people who did different things. So if your skill was music, it was also equally recognized. So it wasn't just a case of a hierarchy, that it was rugby and nothing else. So you had a lot of people who now had the opportunity to express themselves in playing musical instruments, being in debating, being in Toastmasters, and they would be awarded school colors and awarded for excelling in that.
So you mean there were a few areas that are socially more valued, you know, from academics or just recognized point of view, and you would do those things and you would be looked at. The first image that came to my mind is the one of, you know, the jocks in American movies, where it's like, if you're part of that crowd, then you're awesome. And if you're not, then maybe you're not treated as well by your fellow school friends or things like that. Is that equivalent?
That's how it was a lot when we grew up. And I'm sure Bruce can share on that. And as we progressed through high school, there was a lot of equalization of that. And that people who weren't as sporty got recognized, which I think is a fantastic thing.
I think Bongai and I sort of went to senior school during that transition. But there was very much that American characterization of American football as to rugby was very, very similar. You know, it's a good one, I think.
Okay. So what you're describing here sounds like a pretty good, you know, pretty amazing environment. And I'm curious, you did mention that there is a lot of, you know, there are a lot of differences between the different neighborhoods and the rural areas and the urban areas. What you're describing sounds like a wonderful environment to grow up in. How different would it be in other areas? I mean, I guess my question is, how unique and exceptional was that environment? Was it really a few schools in the country, or did everyone have more or less of a similar environment to grow up in?
Sure. I think if you look at the schools, you've definitely got your private schools, and your private schools tend to be the more well-resourced schools. Mm. And greater parent participation encourages and ensures that the schools are able to offer a wide range of skills. So you'll have parents who will come in and coach and assist, and various donations made and equipment. Then you have what are your government schools, but then there's also top tier government schools which have good alumni networks, which also help and provide support. And then there are government schools that aren't as well resourced. However, when you look at it from an environment of where you grow up, the ability to play sports, you know, great weather, pretty much 12 months of the year, you know, we have a very short winter, and even then it's not bitingly cold. You've got a lot of activity. You know, kids very much are encouraged to run around and play. There's lots of after school clubs, and you can get very involved in those clubs and activities. And when I look at it in terms of country to bring up children, even though we are going through a number of challenges here, you know, I've lived in a few other countries around the world, and I would struggle to find a better country to bring up children in anywhere in the world. Bruce?
Yeah, I'd agree, although I did move away when we have children. But I think a lot of it depends on being able to find the right work. And also there's a kind of mentality, I suppose, in Zimbabwe that you need to be able to have. It's a kind of forging ahead, make a plan, do what you can, make your own, you know, sort yourself out. And that was something I never really got to grips with in a major way. I'm quite happy to I never liked the fact that the medical system there is very much based on, it's almost an American system, isn't it, Bongai, where there's no government medical coverage,
NHS, no
nothing like that. And also I think I don't know. I've kind of lost the track of the question. I just wanted to go back a bit, Patrick, if you don't mind. And we're talking about growing up in Zimbabwe, and I think one of the things that I think needs to be stressed that it was like in Zimbabwe, and I think still is that when you look at inequalities, and I work where I work, we actually do, and across Scotland, we look at inequalities, people in different deprivation bands. I think in Africa they're much more contrasted, and in Zimbabwe, well, I know in South Africa and Zimbabwe where I've lived, it's much more contrasted. You're going to have the well-off are going to have a lot, and those who don't have a lot, as Bongai said, you know, there are people who will have to go to, you know, the girls in the family will go and get water in the morning from the wells. And
that's the second time you guys have referenced the fact that the girls are going to go get water and help the women cook and things like that. I'm curious why, and then it's an interruption, but why the girls? You know, why do you feel that you need to mention that the girls will do it? What do the boys do? Are they, you know, basically that question?
Bongai can probably give more to this, but I think there's more of a sort of cultural divide there. When you look at the Shona and Ndebele and the actual African cultures, it's still... It's getting better. I don't know, Bongai. You might be better to answer this one.
I think, well, like you said, it's very traditional, patriarchal. We are old school in our communities, and there's very much a big division of labor, division of roles. There is, you know, for fear of sounding sexist, women's work and men's work. And I'm saying that's not my terminology, but that's how things are perceived. In an urban setting, it might not be as abrupt or as defined as that. Mm. But yeah, stark, exactly. That's a good. But it's still relevant. You know, a lot of people will. Women are homemakers. They tend to be. Even if a woman goes to work, you know, there is an expectation that she'll come home and cook for her husband and keep a good house, which is interesting as well, because we have a culture which, you know, across the board, even people who live in the high density suburbs, the less affluent, will have domestic workers. So someone can be living in a non-affluent suburb but will still have a maid, might not necessarily have a gardener. But that's also, yeah, it's also something very striking that we have, which doesn't really apply around many places in the world. Sub-Saharan Africa is big when it comes to having domestic workers, in terms of helpers, gardeners, maids, who cooks as well. So for women who are in more affluent areas, they don't have to have that same social burden of having to cook and clean. Whereas the lower you are, you will, even if you do have domestic help who comes in occasionally, there'll still be an emphasis on women being the homemaker. So that's engendered into the children from a very young age. Boys, rural areas, will go and herd cattle, will go and work in the fields. The girls will do the domestic work along with getting water, etc. So, yeah, very patriarchal society that we live in, and sort of gender roles are defined at a very early age.
Okay, that makes sense. So do you mean that they do that, the children do that before going to school in the morning?
Most likely, yeah.
So herding cattle and getting water and all of this before school?
Some would, not all. It's hard to generalize and say that that's what everyone does across the board. But if you look at the kids, the girls would probably almost do that definitely when they wake up in the morning. Boys, it would depend on what chores they have. They might come back and do them. There was a time when it was considered that, you know, sending girls to school, etc., was also a waste of time or waste of money when you had limited money. But now, you know, there's a lot more education. People are really enlightened, and it's important. I mean, we look at Zimbabwe, we've got the highest literacy rate in Africa, 92%. That's come about because people recognize the value of education.
So most girls, even in rural areas, would go to school, I'm guessing, until at least 12 or 13 or even longer. Yeah.
Primary education is definitely something that is almost universal.
Okay.
Then obviously the constraints when it comes to funding, etc., might have some level of limitation on how far people go. It was a very big thing in the past, but I think it's got significantly better. And, you know, parents realize that, you know, education is one of the best paths out of poverty.
You know, so I want to get back to men's jobs and women's jobs. I'm curious to hear about that a little bit more. But before we go there, maybe a question I should have asked earlier, I just realized. Could you tell us, for you, how is Zimbabwe different from the rest of, let's maybe not go to the entire continent of Africa, but maybe the rest of sub-Saharan Africa? You mentioned there's a very high literacy rate. Or how would you guys from Zimbabwe say, you know, describe the differences between you and the few other countries?
That's an interesting question. If you look at some South Africa, Namibia, Zambia, I think there's a lot of similarities. Obviously, South African economy is more developed and they've got better infrastructure. But in terms of who we are as people, I think we've got a lot of similarity between your different areas. And in terms of even the way the cities and towns are built up with your high density suburbs, or South Africa, they will call them the townships, and your local, the same kind of zoning, but it happens. And then what you'll have is also in terms of culture, you know, there is strong black culture and the certain perceptions around it, where things like your dowry, you know, lobola, same name in Zimbabwe, it's in Southern Africa, will have those similar themes. Families getting together, the gatherings, the community, etc. Then extending in, even into what I call the blend of black and white culture. You know, braais, which you call barbecues, or we call them braais, but the barbecues, very similar. That, you know, that rugby culture we spoke about, very similar. I think we probably have more familiarity or similarities with South Africa and Namibia and Zambia to a certain extent. When you look at some of the other countries in southern sub-Saharan Africa, it's a little bit different. You might see Kenyans as well. The Nyama Choma also gathering. We all like to gather around meat. And I think it's very interesting as well. Here we are talking about rugby, but football is the biggest sport in the country, and football is the biggest sport in Africa. So you'll have a lot of people going down to the games and supporting their teams and wearing their colors. So I think there's a lot of similarity, but the further north you go in Africa, I think the less and less similarities that we have
So what will start to differentiate? What will be the things that are different if you go further north?
I think just things using your language. We speak a lot of English in this part of the world. English has become the lingua franca. And particularly when you look at Zimbabwe, you've got two major, although you've got 16 official languages, you've got three major languages, Shona, English, and Ndebele. And
does English everyone speak English?
Most people do. Most people do. Can't say every single person, but most people do. And that's the language of instruction at schools. There has been a lot of discussion and debate around whether we need to have languages, or we need to have, certain subjects being taught in local languages and local dialects, and the need for that, which involves a whole major change to the curriculum. Because, like I said, the language of instruction is in Shona. Is English. So people are talking about teaching mathematics in Shona, teaching it chemistry and physics in those languages, to say that it gives kids who have those languages, their primary language, the opportunity to excel. So you'll find that the average person in Zimbabwe speaks a minimum of two languages.
Sorry, the idea is that their primary language would be not English, and English is, as you said, the lingua franca, so everyone speaks it to understand each other, but it's not necessarily the native language of most people. So it would be interesting to change some of the curriculum to those languages so that they can actually do better, right? Is that the logic behind it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So if you're saying we've got a country that has 92% literacy, you've got the cornerstones and the basics of developing a community and a society that's educated. But sometimes you might be hindering certain kids because while they speak English, English is not their first language. Someone will have to think in one language, then translate back. And I'm sure many non-native English speakers will understand that when you hear a word, you translate into one language, translate it back. And even though the synapses are firing, there is that little delay. And sometimes it also results in a lack of comprehension. So there has been a push for that, a lot of debate. And right now, there's advocates on both sides. Some people saying it's a waste of time, and how do we develop the language? I'm one of the advocates of promoting it, because every language is dynamic and you learn things. I mean, you even think about English, pre-internet, we wouldn't have talked about phishing on Bitcoin and capture. Things like that, which are now just common phrases. In France, you got the Académie Française, which will, curate language and add language they'll look at it and say, we don't have a word like that.
We need that new word, or we'll invent one word. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So I think that's important.
Yeah, it's definitely, something that I can relate to. I speak a few different languages, and something that struck me when I first started really learning and really speaking a different language was how it's not just about, not just about learning the language, but it also brings you, when you finally are comfortable enough in that language that you don't need to translate in your own head, the new language, when you're speaking or thinking in that different language, I think it changes the way you, it's hard to explain, but the way you react, the way you you are, really. Language, I truly believe this, I'm a different person when I mainly speak French and when I mainly speak Japanese or when I mainly speak English. It changes the way you perceive the world and the way you react to the world. So I definitely understand what you're saying when you're talking about that. But so for people listening who only speak one language, I think that's a really interesting thing. Like culturally, it's a wonderful experience to have that richness. And when I say I always listen to, I always watch movies or TV shows in their regular, their original language and try to read subtitles. That's part of the reason. You lose something when you translate. There's no way around it. So Anyway, that's a slight digression. But so there's one thing you referenced earlier, which I want to come back to really quickly for just a second. But you did mention that you have, I can't remember how you put it, but mixed, black and white populations. I'm looking at Wikipedia right now. And in Zimbabwe specifically, the black African population is by far the largest majority, 99%, and 0.2% of white Africans. So since we have Bruce here and you met in school, I don't want to delve into caricature, and that's why maybe I didn't ask it initially, but I am curious, how was it to have a white friend? Was it a common thing because maybe of your environment and your school? Were there a lot of white people? Was it weird to be friends with a white person? Just, your thoughts on that.
I think just having Bruce as a friend is a bit of a weird thing, eh?
Maybe that's because of Bruce himself and not because he's white. Maybe he's weird. But,
Well, it'll be fun if Bruce can go first because, white people are a minority in Zimbabwe. So it'll be interesting to look at it from a minority perspective. And I'm happy to chip in afterwards, yeah.
From minority... Well, it's interesting you say that, Bonga, because... I mean, the schools we went to, they were mostly white, though, weren't they? I mean,
when we got at St. John's in our year,
yeah,
of what was it, 60 odd kids, there are only two black guys in our year.
Really?
So, yeah.
Okay, so you were you managed to be the minority in Zimbabwe by being black.
It's it was like that through a lot of my growing up. In Zimbabwe, it was very much white dominated. You wouldn't believe it, and you wouldn't think it, but it was very white dominated. It's only really recently that the more affluent schools have become, more black, and obviously it's a good thing. It's it needs to happen, but I grew up in a very, I think protected,
sheltered.
I was very much in a cocoon growing up. I didn't realize 99% of the issues going on around me, because I grew up and most of my friends were white. I had black friends, and there was never really a question in my head about that. But it was always accepted that the maid or the I'm using inverted commas, help, was always going to be black. It would have been very strange to have a white maid or a white gardener growing up.
So was there a moment when you realized, I'll share a very quick story here, maybe that it can relate to that in a weird way. My mom was born in Egypt, grew up in Lebanon, or part of her childhood, and she has an accent when she speaks French. And I remember I was about 18 or 19, and I was speaking with her, and she said, "Oh, I went to do these administrative things," and the person in front of me realized I had an accent, and she asked where I was from, blah blah blah. And I looked at her bewildered, and I was like, "Accent? What do you mean?" And she said, "Well, my accent, I speak French with an accent." I'm like, "No, you don't. What are, and it took me like, it was 18 years of my life that sort of changed in an instant when I realized that my mom had an accent, which I didn't think she did. She was just, my mom, and that's how she spoke, and it was French. So I didn't, it didn't compute. Did you have a similar moment when you realized... wait, all the help is black? There's something weird here.
I don't know. It's kind of strange to think about it, but I don't think there was a moment for me. I think it was a realization, and it was only when I moved to, well, I first went to university for a bit in South Africa, but then I moved to London in my early 20s, and I started to look back, and it wasn't, I can't say I put my finger on an exact moment, but I started to look back and think, hold on a second here, you know, I'd, this word privilege is thrown around a lot these days, and I think it can be overused by some of the far left. But I think that there is something in that, in saying that I had a very privileged upbringing, and the fact that my skin color played a lot into it was, you know, had a lot to do with it. Even going, Zimbabwe had been independent for what, 20 years. There was still, there's still ingrained, I don't know, Bonga, I don't know if you'd call, I don't know if you agree with this, but prejudices, I don't know if that's a too strong a word or not strong enough, but you know, growing up, I look back and think, wow, I used to actually believe this. I used to actually think that this was the way things are, and, you know, certain people from certain backgrounds have certain places. To put it bluntly, and it's a racist way to think, and it's very strange to think that, and to look back and suddenly realize it. And I've always been viewed as almost being overly liberal by my family, and when I started to sort of question my upbringing a bit, it was a bit it was a bit strange, I think, Patrick. It's strange to sort of talk about it here, but It still makes me uncomfortable to this day, and I don't think there'll be. It's not like I'm ashamed, because you know you come from where you come from, and you learn from your surroundings and where you are. But realizing you grew up in a very much a cocoon, in a bubble where you didn't see, and I don't know, Bonga, if you saw a lot of what was going on, but you didn't really see the news of what was going on in the rest of the country, and the, you know, some of the hardships that people had. You know, I got in a car, I got driven to school every day. I had a wonderful life. I'd play rugby after school, and I'd you know, chess club, as Bongai said. I was even in a bridge club in senior school. You know, used to play bridge.
So you were 80 in senior school, is what you're saying, playing bridge?
Yeah,
but you know,
my parents were ranked internationally in the late 70s.
All right,
you see. But yeah, so that's it's an interesting, it's go ahead.
No, I think it's really interesting what you're talking about with privilege, and it's kind of, you know, a lot of people will listen to this and think, but of course, what are you talking about? You know, you were being driven around, all the help was black, and of course you could, you know, it's obvious privilege, but surely these other situations are different. And I think obviously they are, but it's the characteristic of privilege that you don't really realize it. And I think when you do, you kind of try and justify it, even when it's smaller types of privilege. So it's a really interesting frame of reference to put around it. But we'll move on from the topic fairly soon. I just want to ask Bongai if you have anything to add to that, you know, the way you look at it, or your experience with this, and then we'll talk about other things.
I think one thing we have to acknowledge is that in the time that we grew up, privilege was predominantly race-based. And it generally still is, in the fact that, you know, white people, while they might be minority in Zimbabwe, tend to be generally more affluent. So if you look at representation, well, there's only about 20, 30,000 odd white people in the country. They are probably more, they've probably got a lot more wealth than if you look at average numbers. So growing up and being the only black guy in my class in grade one, it wasn't a startling experience as such. It was just sort of fine, because that's what I knew. You know, I went to school with a bunch of white boys, and as we went on, more and more there were other black guys that came into the class, guys of Indian and Pakistani origin. It was more when I went to the high school that I the high school that I went to, where it was contrasted, where there were a lot more black guys. And now when you look back at certain things that happened at junior school, you do notice that I wouldn't call it overt racism, but there were incidents which make you go, And, you know, having grown up in a privileged environment, I think, you know, Bruce and I are far from representative of what Zimbabwe is as two privileged kids. I think the irony, well, not the irony, the reality is Bruce is representative of the average white Zimbabwean, and I'm definitely not representative of the average black Zimbabwean.
Right.
So that probably paints the right kind of picture for you. So yes, affluence is a very, very acknowledged thing from an early age, because I would get to see how relatives who weren't as affluent, and what you do in Zimbabwe from the black communities, we have a rural home, you know, kumusha, that's the word in Shona, or ekaya in Ndebele. So there would always be trips to the rural home. And that's when you can also get that contrast, you know. Like I said, the majority of our population does live in the rural areas. So you get the practical realities that not everyone has running water and cable TV and internet. So, yeah, privilege and affluence is a great reality. But then again, at the same time, you know, we can't make apologies for it. It should be a certain standard which we want everyone to live to. You know, everyone in the country should have running water. Everyone in the country should have access to things like the internet. And now, you know, obviously wasn't there when we grew up, but certain things should be, certain basics. And I think that's the important thing that we need for our country. So, yes, we live in a dichotomous environment. But then again, I don't think we should be making apologies for those who have. What we should be doing is to try to pull up those who don't have.
So I'm going to come back to the question of the internet, I think, towards the end of the show, because I mainly cover technology and that's fascinating to me. But I wanted to ask, how many people live in those rural areas? You know, what percentage of the population does that represent? And also, is there a will or a trend of rural people trying to move to the cities to make a better life for themselves?
Yeah, if you look at it statistically, there's probably about 70% of our population lives in the rural areas. And even within the rural areas, the communities will differ. In some rural areas, there are what we call growth points, which are your more built up areas, you know, that do have your electricity and running water. And there's some very poor, you know, rural areas where people have to walk as far as 10 kilometers for fresh water, etc. And that's probably a big irony, and we're very shielded from this.
When you were saying the girls need to get the water, is that what you're talking about? Like in the morning, they'll walk 10 kilometers to get the water in the morning?
Yeah, that's an extreme. But it's an extreme that exists. So I don't want to portray that to be the norm, that everyone's waking up first thing in the morning at the crack of dawn to walk 10 kilometers to get fresh water. And also what you'll find is that they won't be doing that on a daily basis. So obviously it might be a couple of times a week, and then they'll have their own storage facilities for that water. But I said that just to illustrate the fact that you do have those extreme cases. Even within the rural areas, some people will have boreholes and pumps, and they'll have water that's running, you know. So there exist those different elements within the rural areas. So rural population of Zimbabwe is about 70%. There was in the past a very strong urban migration, people moving to the urban areas. But even within our urban areas, there is a lot of what I prefer to term underemployment. And the reason I call it underemployment rather than unemployment is because we've informalized a lot of aspects of the economy. So you'll have a person who will be a plumber, and he runs around doing private jobs for individuals, as opposed to having a plumbing company that's registered and pays all its taxes, etc. So more cash in hand jobs. And he might not be as busy as he needs to be, but he has a form of employment. He's self-employed. So a lot of jobs have been lost in the formal economy, but there's a big boom in the informal economy. So that migration that used to happen where people said, okay, I'm going into town, I'm going to find a job, doesn't necessarily apply. So you've got, there's a lot less rural to urban migration going on right now.
So because people know that there isn't enough work for everyone in the cities, right?
Exactly. Or if you are going to go into city, you're going to have to work for yourself. But then there are a lot of people who are looking at working for themselves as well. So it's not a guarantee to success in any shape, way, form, or kind.
So talking about the cities for a little bit, could you describe, because I still don't have a really clear picture of what a big city in Zimbabwe would be like. You know, obviously you have electricity and water and internet, so the infrastructure is there, but does everyone have a car? Do you have, public transportation? Is there 35, an hour and a half, commute every day for everyone if they want to go to work? Is there big companies? Like, how, paint us a picture of what a big city is in Zimbabwe.
Bruce, do you want to go ahead and maybe contrast with where you live?
Where as in Zimbabwe or
Zimbabwe.
Where I live in Scotland is very, very rural for the first for Scotland. So it's very different to contrast. But I think in Zimbabwe the public transport's very much for the let's say blue collar workers. I think Bongo, if that might be the best way to put it.
Definitely.
Going back to the colour thing, you'd very rarely find a white person on a public transport. Almost everyone owns a car in the cities. If you live in Harare, which I never lived in Bulawayo, Bongo. I don't know how different that was, even though I was born there. You will own a car. Most families will have one person, one car. People working in the city, unless those that commute in on the minibuses. What do they call them? Emergency taxis? Do they still call them that?
Well, commuter omnibuses now.
Omnibuses. That was it. It was emergency taxis. They had the old Peugeot. Was it the 504s back in the day? Wasn't it?
Yeah, nice.
The roads are used a lot. They're used a lot. And one, even in the 2 years I was back in Zimbabwe. Sorry?
Oh, you had a little bit of feedback. Don't worry.
Okay. So, I went back in 2011, and I noticed in the 2 years I was back, the roads got more and more congested in that short time. Traffic jams became a real thing. But in saying that, my commute to work, I used to work in the industrial areas for my dad's company for a while. And that was about a 25-minute, 30-minute drive into work from one of the suburbs, which was Borrowdale, into Graniteside, which I think would have been a fair commute. That was sort of what most people did during the day. The cities themselves, I don't really have much of an insight into that, Bongo. The actual workings of how people run, how people get in. There were lots of commuter omnibuses coming in. People paying a fair amount of money in transport that was quite unreliable.
Go ahead, Bongo.
Yeah, I think when you look at it. From an urban perspective, if you look at Harare, we're talking about sub-Saharan Africa.
Harare is the capital for people who don't know.
Harare, yes, sorry, it is the capital of Zimbabwe. You know, when you contrast it with some of the cities, like I say, okay, if you compare it with Joburg, there's no comparison. Joburg has a lot of highly developed public transport, like Bruce is talking about. They've got the Rea Vaya, they've got the Hout train, but a lot of people drive in Joburg, which is pretty similar to what happens here. More affluent people drive, but also you've seen it cascading down as more and more people buy secondhand. The secondhand Japanese car market is huge into Africa, so someone can get a car for $4,000 or $5,000, I'm talking about US dollars, and they'll have a car landed here. And so you're finding a lot of middle class people who in our time relied on public transport are now big commuters themselves. So that's definitely added to the congestion when it comes to traveling and commuting. But it's nothing like, you know, the traffic that you're going to see in Johannesburg, or you're going to see even in Lusaka or in Nairobi with their notorious traffic jams.
And that's a sign, the fact that they can afford these cars, that's also, you know, part of the picture painting I was talking about. It means that a $4,000 or $5,000 investment is achievable for many people. And it means that the fact they can do that, if they couldn't before, means the population is getting richer and more well off, I'm guessing. It's not like the investment of a lifetime to get a car. So,
no, definitely not. Upward mobility is definitely something that's happening more and more. You see it even in terms of the type of houses that people are building, you know, and a person who's on a civil servant salary, and civil servants is the majority of the working population in Zimbabwe, can afford a car, can afford to build a house, you know, will be able to get access to lending, etc., which is a good thing. That's what you need. You need to have that upward mobility in society. You need to create a bigger middle class. You know, I think that's an essential element. People who have enough money to be able to send the kids to the best schools that they can afford and focus on education, etc. I think that's a crucial aspect that's needed and is necessary in this country. We're seeing it more and more. And it's a good thing. It's a good thing. Yes, while the traffic jams might have increased, it's still a good thing that people have cars. Yeah.
So if we talk about I didn't want to ask that question, so I'm going to get back to it. The women's job and men's job, again, with the idea of trying to paint a picture of what every day is like in maybe the capital or where, you know, the big cities. What would be considered a man's job and a woman's job in those urban areas?
Whoa, I mean, in the urban areas, like I said, a lot of people have domestic help. So, you know, back in the day, it might have been the man's job to take care of the garden, look after, and the woman to clean and cook. But if people have got domestic help, whether you've got a maid, it might be the job of the wife to make sure that the maid is doing the work that's necessary. You know, she will be the one who goes shopping. And likewise, the man of the house makes sure that the gardener is doing the necessary and doing the needful. But I don't think it's too far different from, you know, what happens in homes all around the world, that, you know, a man must take responsibility for his family. And if you're in your house, you know, doing the little DIY jobs that need to get done, making sure that bulbs are replaced, you know, take your wife's car out and make sure that it's
serviced and good working
order. Exactly. I think those are just the traditional roles that we're all comfortable with. I don't think you have a lot of the stereotypical old school attitudes still prevailing. There are probably pockets where it does exist, but, you know, particularly in your urban environment, you're not really worried about things like that. It's not a case of, this is woman's work, I'm not going to do it. I mean, you know, I grew up with a father that's very traditional, but, you know, he'd cook dinner for us on the weekends. You know, I had no problem with wearing and washing dishes, etc. You know, I do the same thing for my kids. So while I acknowledge that we live in a patriarchal society, you know, we aren't cavemen.
Fair enough. What about employment? Do women often work? Is there, you know, does it extend to this state where women are very accepted in the workplace, or how does it work in that respect?
Absolutely. I think you find that a lot of women work, and people need to work. I mean, you know, growing up, you know, we can, across the board, you can see many families were built up on both families working. And it's a crucial, you know, I when I grew up, my mother went to work every day. She had an opportunity to retire earlier. My father worked. So both members of the family worked. I've got sisters, they all work, married and not married, and working is important. It's a key aspect of getting money for the family coming through. And I don't think we live in a society where people frown upon women going to work. You know, women going to work is encouraged. It was just International Women's Day recently, and you see a lot of publicity and you see a lot of coverage of it going on in the press. In fact, the radio station that I used to work for went through to one of the women's prisons and, you know, carried out various programs and activities, and they have made donations. There's a lot going on in and around that. In the past, when it's International Women's Day, certain radio stations would only have women broadcasting. You know, parliamentarians would be going out and having particular messages and activities in and around what's going on with regards to Women's Day. So women working and being accepted in the work environment is it's just natural, and it's very much part of our society.
Right. So it seems like Women's Day, to take that specific example, was just as big a deal in Zimbabwe as it was in many other parts of the world, in the Western world, it seems.
Without a doubt. Who knows? It might have even been bigger. You know, there's a lot of noise being made about it. A lot of those activities and days, and the ones that highlight social causes, are very big on our calendar. You've got a lot of local organizations, and a lot of non-governmental organizations, not-for-profit organizations, plus various arms of UN, you know, who will be very actively involved in doing those things. And it's important that they work on doing those things. So it's key and important for us to have those organizations that you know, are emphasizing things, whether it comes to children like UNICEF and WHO, etc. So, yeah, very active in Zimbabwe.
Actually, that brings me to another question, which might be a little bit difficult to answer. But before we move on to the question about tech and the internet, which I definitely want to ask you about, how would you... I don't even know how to ask the question, but what do you think of the Western world's views on your country and maybe even the continent? But, you know, it seems to me that we're sometimes a little bit condescending, or maybe, you know, we're trying to help a lot of good intentions. And maybe you look at this and think, guys, that's very nice, but that's really not what we need. Or is there anything there that you can talk about? Or is that something that I'm thinking about because I'm from the Western world?
I think there's two aspects that immediately come to mind. The first is perception. And generally, if you're talking to an audience outside of Africa, so it's not even just your Western audience, it could be people in the Middle East, it could be people in Asia, people in Australasia, the perception of Africa is very much a stereotypical perception. You know, I went to school in university in London, and there were the odd questions, how did you get here? And I'm like, on a plane, you know, how do most people get here? Or the one where your English is so good, I'm saying, yeah, I'm a quick learner. You know, it was a 10-hour flight. I read lots of books and listened to audio tapes. And so you have those stereotypes, or do you have wild animals in your back garden and stuff like that? Some born out of ignorance, some born out of malice.
I almost asked that myself, if I'm being honest. I was like, so dead, do you have like cheetahs running around in the background? Or
no, so I mean, I live in a very urban dwelling. And while a lot of our houses might have big gardens and swimming pools and tennis courts, etc., the only animals you're really going to find are people's dogs and cats and whatever other animals people might keep, you know, but not wildlife. Sure. You know, that very much, we don't really have zoos. We have national parks, we have game parks, etc. So people can, you know, you can actively see that within where I live in Harare. You know, if I drive 30 minutes in either direction, I can go to a national game park, or not a full-on big game park, but, you know, where you can go and view animals or go on a mini safari. So we do have a lot of animals and wildlife, and we have a lot of greenery and beautiful nature. In fact, that's one aspect which does fit the stereotype in terms of beautiful country, large savannas, great plains, beautiful trees, mountains, rivers, the Victoria Falls. You know, Will Smith was recently bungee jumping off there. So we do have that. But then I think there's aspects when I'm talking about big cities and us having gone to schools which compete, you know, where you have students who go from our schools and they go to Oxford and they go to your Ivy League schools around the world and they can compete because that's the nature of the educational background that we've had. So I understand how people might not be able to fathom it, because a lot of the projection media wise, etc., is famine and war in Africa. And yeah, that is a real story, but it's not the single story. Africa is a multifaceted. Zimbabwe, you know, has so many different aspects, you know, positive, negative, contradictions, dichotomies, that you can't get your head around every aspect completely until you actually spend some time and invest some time in getting to know it. Then when it comes to your second aspect in terms of the need, you know, there are real needs in this country. And I've spoken about kids having to walk distances. The other day I went to a charity event which was raising money for pads for kids in rural areas, because they're girls of school going age who can't go to school for a certain number of days because they don't have the necessary accessories for when they're going through menstruation. So it might seem just like an obvious thing when you walk into your local supermarket, your Tesco, your Carrefour, or whatever it might be, and be able to pick up a bag of pads. But for someone living in a rural environment, that's a significant cost. That's money that they might not have. So this campaign was about reusable pads, and you know, they get donated to the kids. So those are real needs. You know, there are real needs around education and health. HIV prevalence, those are real needs. There's real needs on making sure that our doctors have sufficient funding. And there's a lot of money that does come in through Global Fund, USAID, you know, PEPFAR, which was launched by George Bush, that initiative in terms of cutting down the prevalence of HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. Those programs are real, and they're active, and they actually do make an impact. So it's good that you have the support that comes through. And we do have support that comes through from, you know, various multi-table donor institutions that come in and support. Sometimes I criticize in the sense that I think that it creates a moral hazard where our government might be in a position where they think that they don't have to allocate certain resources to things because they're going to get the donor support. But that's just a personal opinion. When I look at it from a bigger perspective, I'd rather have that support and help so those marginalized and vulnerable communities in our society can get the assistance that they need and deserve.
So you mean overall, it's always hard to generalize. And every time I ask these kinds of questions, I'm, you know, reminded of the fact that different people have different opinions. But overall, you would say that people think the help of the West in many areas is welcome and isn't looked at as something super condescending beyond what you described when you landed in Oxford and people were asking, oh, how did you get here?
Yeah, I think it's important how it gets channeled. And one of the things, the buzzword, you know, I hate using buzzwords, but it's real, is sustainability. So if you look at any initiative that's meant to help people, it has to be sustainable. You know, I'm involved in a conservation trust which is focused around angling. And one of the initiatives that people were talking about is to say a lot of people who are in that community fish because they need the food, the protein. Some people fish so they can sell, so they can get money. But the question was to say, okay, how do you ensure that people don't overfish? How do you ensure that people actually just get enough that's necessary? And then people were talking about doing donations for food. And there was a big outcry to say, well, actually, you know, you create a moral hazard in that you start donating food and the people expect it. And, you know, budgets get cut. You might not necessarily have the ongoing funding. So that was just an example to say, if an initiative is there to make an impact, it must be sustainable. It can't be dependent on continuous donor support. So even if you look at it in terms of the modern world, you know, there's a lot more emphasis on social activities that actually empower communities for the long run. And, you know, there's actual businesses that are actually commercializing social enterprise. Social enterprise is a business venture that looks at impacting communities in a positive manner and sustainable manner. So help is very welcome and very necessary. But if it's going to be help that makes a continuous impact, let it be sustainable. And sustainability for me is the key.
Isn't there a saying which is something like, give a man a fish, you feed him for a day, teach a man to fish, you feed him forever, something like that? Maybe it's not with fish.
Absolutely. But that is true. That is true. You know, if it's a one-off event like a flood, etc., yes, you can direct resources for that specific activity. But
sure, disaster release, things like that. But yeah,
absolutely.
All right, let's finally get to that. I was going to say trivial topic of technology, but certainly it isn't trivial. I mean, infrastructure, and it's essential because it enables so much else to function. So technology, my initial impression would be that your situation is that with smartphones, the country started to get connected a lot more, and it's the primary way people access the internet, meaning smartphones or, you know, feature phones. Would that be accurate, or does everyone have a computer anyway and has had for, you know, 20 years, so you don't really care about smartphones?
No, phones by far are the largest. If you look at the mobile penetration rate in Zimbabwe, I think it's about 95%. So
when you say mobile, you're not talking about only smartphones, right?
No, I'm talking about across the phone. So across the board in terms of your feature phones and your smartphones. So with your smartphone penetration, I think it would probably be in your 50% region. And that translates into what you see in terms of your internet penetration. Internet penetration in Zimbabwe is 50%. I think it's gone down from 51%. So it's gone down one percentage point. So 50% is not bad. It's not good, but it's not bad either. So what you're finding is people with feature phones have still been able to access things like Bainu, still be able to get things through that.
I'm sorry, I don't know what Bainu is.
Well, Bainu is a way of people being able to access internet services using feature phones.
Okay.
So it's
what
basically
kind of which services would they have access to? Low data access, I see. What kind of services? Like, so, is it Facebook?
Facebook, or Twitter, Google, Wikipedia. So Bainu. It's very interesting. I haven't actually used it myself, but I know quite a few people who use it. I remember reading an article the other day that saying about 350,000 Zimbabweans still use it, you know, and it's one of the cheapest ways of staying informed. It's got a lot of little applications, etc., and it basically allows people to have access to all these things in a way that, because it compresses data,
right?
You know,
right.
You don't have, and your images and text, so it's cheaper, and it works on a lot of the old phones. So basically, if someone's got an old Symbian or Android device, they can still access that. But you know, when you look at smartphones, without a doubt, smartphones are essential, and that's how a lot of people access internet. You've got a lot of internet on telephones. We've got cheap internet that's come about through the mobile services, where people get an all-in package, which will give you, you know, a lot of data, your calls, and then you also have various packages. You can even get a Facebook package. You can get a WhatsApp bundle. We call them bundles, which will give you access. You can choose to get access for a day or for a week or for a month. And that allows a lot of people the ability to be online at a limited cost. When someone knows that they just want to be able to access WhatsApp, and then when they want to access data, they'll be able to buy a bundle that's just relates. It can be a daily bundle, you know, which is cheaper, or they'll get their weekly bundle. So even if someone's got a dollar in their pocket, they can have access to the internet. Then there are a number of
Sorry, just to specify, when you mentioned a WhatsApp package or a Facebook package, you mean you'll pay a certain amount relatively cheap and you'll be able to access Facebook for an amount of time unlimited, but only Facebook. Is that what you mean?
So, yes. So your Facebook bundle will give you only Facebook. So all the sites that are optimized for viewing within Facebook. So like when you do click on a link, it'll allow you to stay within Facebook and access that data. Whereas, you know, there's some links where you click out and it'll say Facebook will now access externally. Unless you have the data on your phone or data bundles or airtime, you won't be able to access that. When it comes to WhatsApp, the WhatsApp bundle is a WhatsApp bundle. You can even get a Twitter bundle, which gives you access to Twitter only.
So it's for specific services. How much does it cost, roughly? Do you know?
You know, you can get a monthly Facebook or WhatsApp bundle that will probably cost you about $6. You get weekly bundles, it'll be like $2 or $3, and you can get a daily bundle even.
Facebook becomes like this. For Americans, like an AOL kind of service where you only have access to Facebook, but then you can access the outside sites, but you're going to use up some of your data in that case, but it's separated.
Yes, that's it. Exactly that. And so now in the past, you had a lot of people who were using WhatsApp and using WhatsApp bundles. They were even sending documents to each other instead of emailing it. You know, so you could get, people would get access to the information that was necessary. I knew some kids who would change the end of a file and make it an audio or an MP3 file, save that file, and then just change it back to an XA file. You know, right? It's because you could send it via WhatsApp. So now what happened is they've introduced fair usage policies on some of these bundles.
I see. And so I'm guessing that this kickstarted a big part of the economy. How is that the case? How big is it? Is it, like, I'm guessing, essential now that people use smartphones for everything?
In your urban environment, you know, a lot of people do have cell phones or do have smartphones. So a lot of people are going to be online all the time accessing information. And for example, WhatsApp, it's not just a social tool. Yeah, and I look at my business, WhatsApp is probably the biggest form of communication that we have going on in our business. With our various stores, all the managers will send their daily turnover information by WhatsApp. So we get that information and see how the different stores have done overnight. So I'll wake up in the morning, or if I'm still up when the shop closes, I'll have an idea. I'll say, oh, that shop did well today. That shop did well. It gives a snapshot, gives indications of if there are any problems, overs and unders. It's a way to broadcast to staff, to give staff information if there's changes on rosters that they need to be updated on. You know, you just have a WhatsApp group. You can have 256 members in there. You know, when you have group activities, you know, WhatsApp's there. So I use, from personal perspective, I use WhatsApp social. It's where I stay in touch with alumni all around the world from my school, where I use it for business and stay in touch with family. So it's very much a used tool in Zim. You'll find across the board, you'll have old people who will be on WhatsApp and then know that that's where they can stay in touch with their family. Mm. So
you don't use email for any of this. Email is kind of, it seems like it's an old person's.
Oh, no. Well, email is definitely used. And I am probably a borderline Luddite in that I tend not to use email on my phone. I have multiple email accounts, but I don't have my business email account on my phone. I like to be able to run away from my mail or, you know, have the weekend where I can block off. And so
You still have WhatsApp on the phone. So, and that's one of the many ways, I mean, one of the primary ways apparently you do business. So
it's not intrusive though. I find, you know, when you've got an email and it's always popping up, you got a mail. I can leave my phone or WhatsApp and that's fine. Whereas with email, it's important for me to deal with the messages. And okay. The WhatsApp messages, if they're coming through business, it's a quick thing to deal with. You know, emails, you know, I have to sit down and give it some time and consider. And yeah, there is a time. And I sit down and I do a lot of email. And I'm probably an exception, in truth. I find a lot of people now actually live off their phones. Everything is all integrated. You know, even my business partners will be like, oh, I've just sent you an email. I'm like, well, I don't have my tablet. I don't have my laptop. They look at me like, on your phone? I'm like, no, actually, I don't have it on my phone because it's just a personal choice. But I know a lot of people will do it. You know, you can even, like I said, my local plumber, he'll come over and he'll fix something and he'll send me the invoice from his phone. So tech is used. Tech is embraced. And I think what happens as well, because we are where we are in the world, that we have a lot of early adoption of things. And we also have, because, you, for example, with our cell phone networks, we ended up building, you know, we got LTE and 4G came on quickly because we skipped a lot of stages.
Sure.
Because when the networks aren't as developed, you tend to jump to the next stage and they go out and get the best tech. Exactly.
And so what about so you have LTE everywhere, but the data is still relatively expensive, I'm guessing. You don't have unlimited. I mean, even the US, they don't have unlimited. But you don't have unlimited data. You still have to be careful how much you use it, it seems.
Yeah, it's expensive. I mean, I'm at home right now talking to you on my phone on Skype using... You know, I don't have fiber. I've got an MPLS link, which is slightly better than fiber. And I got it because I was also an early adopter. But in my whole neighborhood, everyone is fiber. You know, ADSL has been phased out, but it's cost. Oh, so, it's expensive.
So, but your neighborhood maybe is a little bit more, you know, well, not provided, well serviced than other parts of the country, I'm guessing. But is fiber a common thing, at least in the capital?
Fibers in Harare, fiber is pervasive.
Wow.
There's one stage where you had a situation where on Monday you've got one group trenching, then on Wednesday there's another group trenching, and on Friday there's another group trenching. So there's been a big case for infrastructure sharing. Because, you know, it's a silly race to have everyone just laying their own fiber all over the country, or putting up towers all over the country. So, you know, the information ministry, which has control over the ICT sector, was busy saying that, look, we need to look at sharing the infrastructure, because, you know, does it make sense for us to go and set up three cell phone towers in the same area?
right.
So yes, fiber's big. ADSL still available. Very few people on ADSL. Cell phone
and
primarily.
Those have
just
caps?
To give you an indication. Yes, a lot of them have caps, but if you want uncapped, it's expensive. So I'll give you an example. I have a 20 meg, which, you know, is average speed, or probably slow by European standards, which is fast by our standards. And it's uncapped. It cost me $150 a month.
Wow. Okay.
So that's a significant amount of money. It's expensive. And, you know, if you look at the reasons why it's expensive, we're a landlocked country, you know, connecting to CECOM and all the other cables, you know, means you actually have to physically trench to another country. So it's hundreds of kilometers. Then, of course, the early investors are trying to recoup the costs of their investment. So we've seen prices gradually going down. But if we want to see the big impact, I think the big impact will come from the mobile space in terms of pricing. And you've seen a lot of pricing wars. So we've got three major mobile networks in the country. And a lot of the battle has been in and around the pricing of data and getting the all-in plans, where they just basically combine your plans, and that's what's proved to be very attractive to people.
So what about commerce? I think we're going to get to the end of our conversation fairly soon, but I do want to ask, you know, like payments and commerce? And is there, I guess, two questions. First of all, how does payment happen online? Is it like bank transfers, or do you have other services? I know there are specific phone services for banking in Africa. And then do you have like online commerce being developed in the country as well?
Yeah, so if you look at it, traditionally, everyone who wanted to do a transaction, go into the bank, fill in a form. And so in our banking sector, we have what's called the real-time gross settlement network, RTGS. So if you want to send a transfer from one person to another, basically you had to go into the bank, fill in a form. There was a cutoff time, whether it's 11:30 or whatever time, for you to do the transfer. That was the traditional way of sending money back and forth to individuals. Then there was disruption, and disruption came about particularly through the mobile space. So your mobile networks, you know, M-Pesa is one well-known example in Kenya. So all the mobile networks in Zimbabwe have mobile banking. So they have mobile wallets. So you can then now transfer money from one person to another via the phone. And that person could be registered or not registered. If the person wasn't registered, basically they'll just have to go to an agent and they could redeem their money.
Then how do they, like, they show the document on their phone, or there's a tracking number, and how do they identify themselves, though?
You have a tracking number. You go to the agent and say, I would like to redeem this amount of money. I'd like to cash out, and this is the reference I've got, and you just show them the ID. So in Zimbabwe, everyone has a national ID.
Okay.
From the day you're born, you're assigned an ID number.
So the person would say, on my phone, I'm transferring that amount of money to that person with that ID number. And
well, you don't even need to have the ID number, just the person's cell phone number.
Oh, okay. And that then translates
into... I'm sending money to your number, and then they'd be able to cash out.
Okay.
And then the ecosystem built up where they developed a whole number of merchants. So you could send me money. Patrick, you send me $100. And then instead of having to cash out, I can go to the supermarket, and I can actually use that money in my mobile wallet and pay the supermarket via my phone. So that ecosystem developed to the point where it's trying to keep the money in the system where people don't have to cash out. That's one example. Then the banks also came to the party with regards to how people did it. So you can send money mobile banking where you actually log into your bank account. And we've got a system called Zipit. So basically I can send money from my cell phone to any bank account around the country. And it actually, I think I've done it from one of my own accounts to another. I think the quickest time was 30 seconds between clicking and getting an SMS confirmation that money's gone from one account to another.
Right.
So that's called Zipit. Then there's apps, mobile banking via your apps. A lot of the banks have mobile apps. Then you're, of course, internet banking. And for me, that's the cornerstone of my business. I do all my transfers via internet banking. So log into my accounts, transfer money around. I will have all my suppliers preloaded, all my employees preloaded as well. I will go in and I can just do batches, and I can put in 50, 60 payments, put the various amounts, put the references, click send, get a batch. I'll get a proof of payment, and the money goes through to the respective people that I'm paying. So
does that also work via cell phone, or do you have to do that on the computer? I'm thinking about the UI. How does it, you know, do you actually click everything?
Oh, yeah, well, it's hard to do it on cell phone, right? Because just the size of the screen.
Exactly.
When you look at some of the different banks, some of it I've got pure mobile banking, pure internet banking is web-based. Some actually have Java applications, so you can't. It's difficult to run the Java app on your phone, or next to near impossible. Mm-hmm. And they'll actually even tell you the screen size not supported. So I will do it on my laptop, or I'll do it on my tablet. But in terms of actually mobile banking or app banking, I can do that from my cell phone. Mm. No problems at all. Yeah.
And so it seems like this makes it kind of mandatory to have at least a dumb phone or a feature phone. What happens when you don't have one? How do you, you know, I most people do have one, I suppose, but
yeah, I think that's why you see mobile penetration is so high at 95%, because cell phones have become, you know, an extension of an individual. It's not just that thing that allows you to pick up and make a call. You know, it allows you to send money to someone, send documents to someone, email a person. You know, the other day I wanted to go to lunch. I just went on Facebook, found the restaurant, clicked the call button, and calling through my reservation. You know, and I just thought about that for a minute. And I said, you know, a few years ago, I'd have had to go and pick up the physical telephone directory, thumb through it, find the number, you know, go to the landline, dial the number, and make the booking. But, you know, I could have even sent them a message to the reservation via Facebook. So you've now got a lot of businesses that have adopted the technology, that have adopted Facebook, are on Twitter, are on Instagram. If I look at my own businesses, you know, I've stopped advertising in the physical media, in the print media. I will go and see we've got an activity that's going on, and I'll go into Facebook and I'll spend $20 to boost it, or $50 to boost the event. And the impact I get is phenomenal.
You know, it's interesting because Go ahead. I was going to say it's the same here. It's very similar. You know, we had probably more computers before, but this idea that the phone has become an extension of your life really is really the same here. And I'm guessing for you guys, it enabled things that weren't possible at all before. But it does to some extent here as well. I'm curious, is there online commerce developing? Because I had a conversation with a friend from Thailand a while back, and he told me that online commerce is definitely booming in Thailand, but of course these are different contexts. So I'm wondering if there is, you know, even the infrastructure for delivery or for, I don't know, but is there, I guess the question is the online capabilities to connect physical entities, or does it also evolve into online only activities?
Yeah, online commerce in truth is very limited. There are a number of companies that will, you know, let you log in and do your grocery shopping online, etc. Some people will do your online delivery if you buy goods online. But it is not a big aspect of anything at all. You know, you're not going to have your major retails like Amazon where people are buying things online. You know, I'm a huge fan. I buy a lot of stuff on Amazon online, but not in the Zimbabwean context. We just don't have that here. So
wait, e-commerce sorry,
in that way, it doesn't really matter.
Let me interrupt. You say you buy a lot of things on Amazon online. You mean from Amazon from where, and you get them delivered to Zimbabwe like it takes a week instead of 2 days, but is that?
Yeah, exactly. So I have the stuff shipped, or I say I've got my sister lives in the US. If she's coming, I'll say, oh, listen, I'm going to buy a few things on Amazon, get it shipped to her, and she'll bring it across.
Oh, but okay. So you don't get it shipped to Zimbabwe directly?
No, I do sometimes. Okay. I do. And Amazon does ship here. But then there are some sites, you know, the non-Amazon sites that are on non-Amazon retailers that are on Amazon who will tell you, sorry, we do not ship that to Zimbabwe. So I'll have to get someone to bring it across. But yeah, it in terms of that happening here, e-commerce is very limited. We are still traditional brick and mortar. Someone will actually go onto a Facebook page or onto a website of a store and see what goods and services are available, then jump in their car and drive across and buy.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. I guess that will... go ahead. Yeah.
Sorry, Patrick. Just a very interesting caveat to what you're saying there about using mobile phones and... just to put it into context, living in rural Scotland here, working for a council, I only just got my work smartphone yesterday. that shows you, you know, that I think one of the things I noticed in Zimbabwe when I was back there is they're a lot more ahead in a lot of ways than some of the rest of the world. And it's like you say, early adoption is something in Africa that I think will push, you know, missing out a lot of the big bulky steps before seem to help a lot. But you know, that sort of thing, like using messages instead of emails, I've been pushing for that at work for ages, but we're still using emails, and we're finding that emailing all the time is actually not useful. You know, we want to get WhatsApp. I want to get Skype working in the work environment. And there's a reluctance to do that, which is very, very strange. When, you know, you look at how well it's being used in Zimbabwe and how well people are using phones and using smart technology. So I was just chuckling away in the background when you were talking about that. And I thought it was quite interesting.
You know, I use email still, and I have a preference for email. You might have noticed in our communication in preparing the show. I think it's just an old school thing, but I feel like email is archivable. Like I can, it's going to stay there. And if I need something, I'm going to go find it. Whereas even, you know, Skype or direct messages on Twitter or all of those, you know, just the messaging services feel less real, like not less real, but less, I don't know. They, it's harder for me. I have everything in one place in email, and that's easy. But if I have to use WhatsApp and Twitter and Facebook and Skype, and I think that's why I do it like that. But I definitely am in that boat of, but why can't we use the old thing that I've been using for, you know, 20 years and that I'm uncomfortable getting away from? So I understand that.
Well, you know, the most real you can get is put it on a, you know, get a piece of paper and write it out. And, you know.
I knew you were going to go there. One last question, actually. It's kind of like the Big Mac Index. You know, how much is a Big Mac in the world tells you something about the purchasing power of that population. I'm guessing, well, maybe I could ask you about McDonald's, actually, but I'm guessing it's mostly Android phones. I'm wondering how many iPhones people have.
Yeah, iPhone's expensive. So Android by far is dominant in the market, and there's actually homegrown brands.
Oh, really?
So you have, yeah. So you actually have, there's a brand called Gtel where the guys have actually got Android technology, built up their own phones, and they do mass market, and they actually sell these phones to a lot of civil servants and students, etc.
And they manufacture in China, I'm guessing, but
yeah, probably is in China. But they've actually brought a whole range of they've got across the board. They've actually now started working in the premium space, and so that's been a good initiative. So feature phone or a smartphone is not that expensive. I mean, you can get a smartphone for $50, $30, $40, you know, your basic entry-level phones.
Wow.
So that top end is reserved for the top end. So if you're looking at your Samsung Galaxy, your S7s, etc., or your iPhone 6s, that market is very small.
Mm. How much does an iPhone cost?
A brand new iPhone 6 probably cost you $1,100, $1,200.
Okay.
Your Samsung Galaxy is probably $800, $900. Yeah.
Mm. And how much for a Big Mac?
We don't have McDonald's in Zimbabwe.
Well, there you go. That's it. Over. I'm never going to Zimbabwe.
they got KFC, though, you know.
Oh.
Yeah. KFC is a recent entrant. So we've in the fast food space, we've tended to have our own home brands. And if you look at one of our fast food companies, Inscore, you know, they're a $1 billion business, and they've spread their wings all the way into East and West Africa. So it proves that, you know, sometimes homegrown does work. So if you're looking at your average burger, what do I say? $2.50, I suppose.
Oh, that's very similar to the prices we have here. maybe a little
I,
bit.
I think yeah, and when I talk dollars, we actually use US dollars, just so your listeners are aware.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But if you like burgers, Patrick, you have to visit Zimbabwe one day. It's the best meat in the world. Best meat in the world, definitely. I heard a rumor that Zimbabwe is one of the few countries that the Argentinian embassy doesn't bring their own meat in.
Oh. All right. Well, you've convinced me. I'm back on the Zimbabwe boat. I'll go there one day. All right. Well, thank you very much to both of you. That was a fascinating conversation. Is there any place online that if listeners want to, you know, get more from you guys, do you have any presence online or not? Maybe Bongai, is that you mentioned your radio shows were available on SoundCloud.
Yeah, on SoundCloud. My name is Bongai, Bongai. And Zamchia, Zamchiya. See some of my previous radio work there. And if they're interested to know what's going on in the Zimbabwean hospitality space, they can have a look at one of my businesses called Pariah State. So just on Facebook, it's Facebook Pariah State. That's casual dining and resto bars, as we call them. And we call it the best bar in Africa.
I can second that nomination from Best Bar in Africa. We went there when we were there in November.
Cool. Well, you might be a little bit biased, but I'll take your word for it anyway. All right. Well, what about you, Bruce? Do you have any online presence you want to promote?
I'm on Facebook, but I'm also on Twitter. I think Bruce Woodward 3. Oh. On Twitter, and otherwise, I'm just a regular, normal person. I'm a bit of a Blizzard fanboy.
As we all.
So I've there's all that, but you know what? Just follow the Phileas Club and Pixels, and you know, I've got to say thank you to Patrick for what you're doing, because I think. This episode, but I think there's some of the stuff you've done in the past with challenging people's views on you know, and even your own views is very good, and I appreciate it, and I hope it carries on for a long time.
Oh, thank you very much. I really appreciate that, and you're kind of making me blush a little bit. Thanks, Bruce. I guess if you want to support the show, if you, like Bruce, think that this show does some good things, you can go to patreon.com/thefiddiesclub and join the number of patrons that are financially supporting the show. I would very much appreciate it. That's an incredible encouragement for me and for the things I try to achieve with the show. If you don't have money to waste on my endeavor, you can always go to iTunes or any other podcast catalog and leave us a review with a few stars. Perdue from Sweden said, excellent podcast with 5 stars, a good way of getting to know more about the world. Thanks for doing this, Patrick. Thank you very much, Perdue. I'm going to pronounce it like that. And I hope that in this episode you did get a little bit of perspective, some interesting facts and figures. And I really want, again, to thank Bongai and Bruce for being on the show. It was super interesting for me, at least. So I guess that is something we've achieved no matter what. And we'll be back in towards the end of the month with a regular episode. It will be interesting again with things happening around the world. I can't wait to tell you what's been happening in the French election. And I'm sure we'll have other things to talk about as well. Again, thank you very much for listening. Thanks, Bruce, and thanks, Bongai. And we'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Cheers.
Oh, hey, bonus question. Bongai, what do you guys think of Trump?
I think there's been mixed reviews of Trump. From a personal perspective, I think it's one of the best things that has happened for a global political perspective, I think it shows that democracy is alive, strong, and well. It also shows the fact that people are unhappy with the current political environment, and that when they choose to make a decision or a choice, I mean, you see that manifested in Brexit, albeit some people will say they didn't completely comprehend what Brexit was. But I think it's democracy in action. I think it's something that should be acknowledged and praised. And while Donald Trump might not necessarily be the best poster boy for this mini rebellion, I think it's a very good thing. I look forward to lots and lots of fun with Trump being president. From a Zimbabwean perspective, you've seen a lot of reaction from our local politicians with the hope and belief that it might result in better relations between Zimbabwe and the USA. I'm not sure that that will necessarily happen, because as the same as Barack Obama was president of the United States, Donald Trump is very inward focused and inward looking. So I don't think he has a lot of time and consideration for us in little Zimbabwe. But the takeaway is definitely that democracy is strong and alive, and that people recognize and realize that they have a voice. And when they band together around a particular cause or individual, they can prevail.
I think that's a very, very different view, Bongai, that, you know, I think a lot of people will think that's, he just looks, from where I'm sitting in the sort of Western world, he looks like a big buffoon, you know, it doesn't really, I don't know.
I understand that concern, and in many ways, when you watch his press conferences and the grandiose displays when he's signing executive orders, you get that feeling. But what I'm encouraged by is that, you know, you look at the institution, the democratic institutions. Trump will issue a travel decree and the courts will turn around and say that's ultra vires the constitution, or whatever law is applying then is applicable. That's the true test, and that's the nature of a democratic process in play. You've got the separation of the institutions. You've got the robustness in place. You've got a situation where government is held to account. And when they do craft legislation or make executive orders, they've got to ensure that it's legal. It might not necessarily be something that we all agree with, but it's legal. And ultimately, you've got to acknowledge the fact that he was elected and he won an election. And he is representing people across America, whether or not they chose to elect him or not.